The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the renowned website builder that helps you share your story with the world in the most beautiful way. Establish a personal brand, portfolio, or e-commerce store at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Hannah Devlin. Coming up on the show, what does a new study reveal about the genetic structure of the British population? An international team has created the first fine-scale genetic map of any country in the world. Its findings shine a light on migration to Britain over millennia, showing where we came from and which of us are most similar to the earliest post-Ice Age settlers. Plus, what can we learn from this week's partial solar eclipse over Britain? This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. What can we learn from the fine-scale genetic variation within a human population? What do the differences between us reveal about the history of migration and colonisation of Britain during the past 1,000 years? And are these differences relevant for understanding the nation's health today? An international team led by researchers from the University of Oxford used DNA samples collected from more than 2,000 people to create the first detailed genetic map of any country in the world. Their findings are published this week in Nature, and I'm pleased to say I'm joined by Professor Peter Donnelly, Director of the Wellcome Trust Centre for Human Genetics, and one of those responsible for the work. So Peter, could you tell us a bit about who the 2,000 people were who took part in this study?
We sampled DNA from volunteers around the UK, all of whom were based in rural areas, and all of whom had all four of their grandparents from the same area.
So these are people who'd all be classed as white British if they were filling in an ethnicity survey, and they all speak the same language and have grandparents in this country. But what did you find out about how they differ genetically?
We were able, for the 2,000 volunteers, to measure their DNA at 500,000 positions across their genome. So we got very extensive genetic information. And then we used sophisticated statistical tools to put the individuals into groups by assessing their genetics and their ancestry to cluster individuals into groups with the property that individuals within a group are more similar to each other genetically and share more of their ancestry within the group than they would between groups.
Could you just tell me a bit about these groups that emerge and which groups jump out first if you're splitting the British Isles up in terms of genetics?
So the first thing to say is that people in the UK of European ancestry, Caucasian ancestry, are extremely similar genetically. They're much more similar genetically to each other than they are to people from other European countries. But what we were able to do is to look beyond all of those similarities and tease out differences. And one way of thinking about it is that we, through these statistical techniques, we can zoom in and see kind of finer and finer resolution on the genetic differences within Britain. So as a start, for example, if you take the 2,000 individuals in our study and you break them up into two groups on the basis of their genetics, those two groups are Orkney, islands off the northeast coast of Scotland, and everybody else in the study. If you imagine zooming in a little bit more and look at three groups, then those three groups are Orkney, Wales, and the rest of England and Scotland and Northern Ireland. When we look for four groups, it's Orkney, North Wales and South Wales, and then everybody else. So in a certain sense, there are more differences genetically between the people in North Wales and South Wales than there are between people in Kent in southeast England and in Scotland.
And just to be clear, these groups that emerge, you're looking at the clusters independent of a map and then plotting the genetic differences back onto the geographical layout of where people came from. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And it's one of the exciting things about the findings. We did the genetic analysis just on the basis of the genetics. We used the statistical methods to group individuals into clusters of similar ancestry. And then we plotted those individuals back on the map to see where they fell. And what wasn't obvious, but was in fact very exciting and striking about our findings, is how much congruence there was between the genetic clustering and where people were based geographically in the UK.
So, Peter, you were looking at 500,000 genetic variants in more than 2,000 people. That sounds like an awful lot of data. Could you just tell us a bit about what you do when you're faced with that mass of data and how you go about sifting through it?
It is a lot of data, but that's a good thing because more data allows you to make more powerful inferences. So we applied recently developed and very powerful statistical methods. So one of the novelties of the study was applying these methods for the first time into a large study within a population. And actually, as an aside, we were able to show that we could find things using the methods we use that we wouldn't have found had we used the standard methods in the field. So very informally, what the statistical methods try and do is, so we take a particular individual in our study, and you can imagine looking along one of their chromosomes. So we share ancestry, we share pieces of DNA with other individuals because of ancestors, usually a long time in the past, hundreds of thousands of years, for example. So that informally what the statistical approach does for a given individual is it finds the pieces of their genome which are most closely related to pieces of the genomes of other individuals in the study, and maybe one piece will be related to of individual 3 will be related to individual 8 and another piece will be related to individual 762 and so on. So we look at that information across the genome, and that's giving us some sense of shared ancestry between the individuals in the study. And then we group the individuals on the basis of that shared ancestry. So the individuals who end up in one of our genetic clusters have similar patterns of this sharing of DNA. I mean, there's a certain sense, because we're humans, in which we're all related. And this is looking at relatives, not in the sense we would normally mean of even second or third or fourth cousins, but relatives in the sense that at a particular part in our genome, the two individuals we're studying might have shared a common ancestor 100,000 years ago or 200,000 years ago or something.
And if we look at the main block, the largest group, which covers the southeast of England, Midlands, and up, right up to parts of Yorkshire, can you tell us a bit about where those people are from in terms of their genetics?
We found one very large group in our study, although the study was powerful enough to see quite subtle differences between Devon and Cornwall, for example. About half the individuals in our study were in a single large group in what covers most of central and southern England. We were able, for that and for the other groups, to try and work out which bits of Europe their ancestry comes from. And for example, for that group in central and southern England, something like 40 or 45% of their ancestry most closely matches that of people in modern France. Another 25% most closely matches people in modern Germany. About 10% that matches people in modern Belgium, and about another 10% that matches people in modern Denmark. So we're not saying that their DNA came from those groups, but the events which resulted in that DNA coming into Britain have happened over the last 10,000 or so years. What would be ideal is if we could take DNA from the populations over the last 10,000 years and match that up to what we see today. We can't do that. The next best thing we can do is to take modern populations in different parts of Europe. So we can look at shared ancestry, which isn't quite the same as saying that the DNA is French, but rather that almost half of the ancestry of people in much of modern England is shared with people in modern France.
I'm really interested in what's driving these differences. Why is it that the Welsh are more different from the rest of England than, say, people from Kent and Scotland? Are these things that are matching up with what we know about historical invasions and migration to Britain from Normans and Romans and Vikings in the past?
So we see subtle but real differences in terms of the genetic makeup of people in different parts of the UK. And those differences are driven by two different sorts of things. One of them has to do with input of DNA, so DNA being brought into the UK by migrants and invaders. So it may well be that people move from one part of Europe into Wales, for example, and bring one collection of DNA variants with them, whereas people might move from another part of Europe into England and bring somewhat different DNA. So some of the differences we see are the result of differential migration and or invasion from Europe. The other source of the differences are that if populations evolve in a relatively isolated way over time, they'll just develop chance differences. So if you took a homogeneous group and broke it into two and let those two populations evolve separately, then in the first of them, just by chance from one generation to the next, some genetic variants would increase in frequency and some would decrease in frequency. And then in the other population, that would be happening too, but typically a different genetic variance. So over a period of time, those two groups, which were initially the same, would develop differences. So the patterns we see in the UK are a combination of those two things. The fact that DNA from different sources in Europe come in differentially to different geographical regions in the UK, and then some story of partial or relative isolation of groups, which allows chance differences to accrue.
Now, after you'd done the main analysis, you also compared the genetics of British people with those of different populations throughout Europe. And that helped you come up with a picture of where people might have migrated in the past and how those groups contributed to the British gene pool. I'd just like you to tell me a bit about what we've learnt and how this tallies up with what we know historically about Roman invasion of Britain and Anglo-Saxon settlers moving across.
So we see a number of different sources for DNA in Britain. Some of what we see, we think, reflects the very early migrations into Britain after the last Ice Age. So there wasn't any population settlement in Britain that survived the Ice Age. So all of the DNA that's now in Britain came in after the last Ice Age, something like 10 or 11,000 years ago. So we see evidence of the early settlers after the Ice Age. And consistent with archaeology, it looks as if some of those came preferentially into the western parts of Britain, plausibly by boat from the Atlantic coast of Europe, what's now France and perhaps Spain. And then some others came in preferentially to the eastern part. After the Ice Age, Britain was joined by land to what's now continental Europe, so people could just wander across, perhaps following game that they were hunting. So we see the evidence of the early settlers. And then the picture subsequently is about different migration events.
So do you see a Roman signature? Is that something that is evident when you look at the map?
We don't see any signature of the Romans. The Romans invaded Britain and controlled Britain for about 400 years. We don't see a strong genetic signal of that. We probably wouldn't have expected to. I mean, we might naively have thought that we'd have DNA that looked Italian in some sense, or like modern Italian DNA. A very small proportion of the Romans who came were actually from Rome and the areas around Rome. They would have been the ruling elite. They brought with them many Roman soldiers, but those Roman soldiers were from other parts of the Roman Empire, Gaul, for example, modern-day France, and bits of modern-day Germany. But the historical record suggested that there wasn't much settlement of Romans in Britain, so we didn't see an impact of the Roman invasion and probably wouldn't have expected to. At the time the Romans arrived, there were perhaps 1 million people living in the UK, so to have an impact on that gene pool would need a fairly substantial number of people to move in.
I think you did find, though, that there was a much bigger contribution from the Anglo-Saxons who moved across. And after the end of the Roman Empire in Britain, we didn't know whether the Anglo-Saxons who moved over replaced that population through driving them out or some kind of genocide, or whether they mixed in with them and lived alongside each other. And I think your study resolves this question somewhat.
Yes, after the Romans left Britain in about 400 AD... the Roman society collapsed, and it was from then onwards over the next 100 or 200 years that the Saxons or the Anglo-Saxons moved into Britain. And there's been a major historical controversy since about whether, as you were saying, whether the Anglo-Saxon population replaced or killed off the existing population. So what we do know is that soon after the Anglo-Saxons arrived, the place names all changed, the language changed, the cereal crops changed, and even the pottery styles changed. And that's what's led some historians to suggest a complete change of people as well. But our study answers that, and it answers it in the other direction. We see clear evidence of Anglo-Saxon DNA in modern Caucasians in Britain, but it's maybe 10 or 20 or 30% of their DNA, well under half. So that, first of all, shows an impact of the Anglo-Saxon invasion, but also makes it clear. So the majority of the DNA carried by Caucasians in Britain, in England now, is DNA that was present before the Anglo-Saxons arrived. So that shows that the Anglo-Saxons must indeed have intermingled with and intermarried with the existing populations.
And in terms of talking about the victors, the Vikings obviously had a big impact on our history. What did you find about the genetics and whether we've really got a lot of Viking ancestry if you look at our genes?
So there are two different sets of Vikings. The Norwegian Vikings travelled and settled and invaded the northern parts of Scotland and the islands off Scotland, or the islands in Orkney off Scotland, were amongst the most different genetically in our study. And then when we looked for the influences of different groups in Europe, they had a clear component of Norwegian DNA. So that's consistent with the historical record. Orkney was in fact settled by Norwegian Vikings in the 800s and remained part of Norway for the next 600 years. And we see evidence of that. Interestingly, about 25% of the DNA in the modern people of Orkney is from the Norse Vikings. So probably even that settlement involved intermixing with the existing populations. Completely separately from that, the Danish Vikings also had a big impact in Britain. They controlled much of the eastern part of Britain, the region called the Danelaw, in what's now Lincolnshire and the regions around that. many current British place names, Rugby, Grimsby, and so on, date from the Viking times. So that was a very powerful and successful invading force. We see almost no impact of that in the genetics. It must have been the case that the Danish Viking success was based on relatively small numbers of people and a very successful military prowess, rather than extremely large numbers of people settling and leaving their DNA for us to find 1,000 years later.
It's amazing that you're using DNA from people alive today as a historical source, essentially. Could you just tell me a bit about how that complements or challenges, you know, historical accounts from other sources, such as historical artefacts and historical records?
Yes, so genetics is one tool we have for understanding our past. The more obvious tools are the historical record, archaeology, linguistics. So one aspect of all of those sources is that they are preferentially about or focus on the successful elites in society. So the archaeology of burials, it's the wealthy people that get buried, and they're the ones that we discover in archaeology hundreds of years or thousands of years later. There's the saying that history is written by the victors, and to some extent that's true. And usually the successful invaders, who may be small in number but powerful in a military sense, impose languages on people. What's different about genetics is that, in contrast to those other sources which tell the story of the successful elites, genetics is about the masses. What we see in, as it were, the genetic record, the DNA in modern people in Britain, is the story of what's happened to the majority of people, the masses, over historical times. So in that sense, it's a natural complement. It's a different source of information, different type of information, and can tell us things about what's happening, as it were, to the ordinary people, rather than just the successful elite.
So do your findings tell us about who today is most similar to that post-Ice Age group of early settlers that moved to Britain?
People in Wales, modern people in Wales, have more of their DNA that's similar to the DNA that came in after the last Ice Age. So in that sense, they're more similar to the very ancient Britons than are people in other parts of the UK, largely because what's happened elsewhere in the UK is that the DNA that was there after the Ice Age has been diluted by the Anglo-Saxons, in some cases in the north by Norwegian Vikings, and a number of other migration and invasion events that didn't impact on Wales nearly as much.
And it's amazing when you look at the map that you see almost precisely county boundaries are reproduced when you just take this genetic data and put it back onto the map. Could you just tell us a bit about which of those you found most striking?
Yes, one very striking finding. We did the genetic analysis independently of the geography. We clustered individuals into groups. We plotted them back on the map. We saw a genetic group in Cornwall in the southwest of England, and another distinct genetic group in Devon, which is the next county to Cornwall. They're very close, and yet we saw clear differences in the genetics. But what was really striking was the way the group we saw from the analyses and then plotted on the map in Devon, the extent of that group almost exactly matched the modern county boundaries. So the patterns we see in the genetics are the result of thousands of years of history, partial isolation, and so on. And the county boundaries are relatively modern things. But in this case, they're capturing, at some level, features that cause separation and relative isolation of people for thousands of years in Devon compared to people for thousands of years in Cornwall.
I think your findings also tell something about the Celts. Often they're seen as a common cultural group. Is that borne out in the genetics?
One of the things we thought we might see was a similar genetic makeup to the Celtic parts of the UK, Cornwall, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland. We did see distinct groups in each of those areas, but they were very distinct from each other. And in fact, some of the most different groups in our study were the various Celtic groups. So North and South Wales already were quite different from each other. The people in Cornwall look different again from the Welsh and from the Scottish and Northern Irish, and much more similar to other people in England. So we didn't find a single genetic group that represents the Celts. You know, various features of their history have actually made them relatively different genetically, which suggests that the Celtishness that they have is very much a cultural and linguistic phenomenon rather than a genetic or racial effect.
So we're moving into an era of personalised medicine where treatments are going to be increasingly tailored to our genes. I was wondering, are there any health implications of the findings?
One of the motivations for the study was the information it can provide us in doing research to understand the genetic components and the genetic basis of diseases. So when we do those studies, typically we take some people who are sick with a disease of interest and compare them to people who didn't have the disease, and we look for genetic differences between the two, which would occur if there were genetic variants that were making someone more likely to get whatever disease we're focusing on. So in order to do that, we need to rule out other possible reasons for differences between the groups, and one set of reasons has to do with just whereabouts in the country people come from. So having the kind of information we now have about the kind of normal or natural levels of genetic variation across Britain can be, and I think will be, quite helpful in doing those genetic studies of disease rather better. And indeed, the data we've collected in our study has already been used in a number of disease studies, not because we have disease information about the individuals in our study, but because we can compare them, as it were, a sample of people from Britain with people who do have diseases. So they get used as controls in disease studies.
So, for example, if a Scottish hospital was collecting data on heart disease and genetics in its patients, that would allow you to filter out anything that's just special about the genetics because it's Scottish.
Yes, or if a Scottish hospital were studying patients with heart disease and they compared them with people from other parts of the country, they might see differences that aren't due to the fact that some of the individuals have heart disease and some don't. It might just be due to the geographical location of the samples. So the kind of information that our studies developed allows us to understand that better and to avoid those confounding factors in disease studies.
So, Peter, in your study, you were looking at people whose grandparents all came from close by to each other. In a sense, you were mapping out the genetic distribution of people at, say, the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. I wanted to just ask about a project that's just launched last week, the East London Genes and Health Project, which is looking at South Asian populations in East London, looking for the genetic reasons behind specific health problems in those communities. Is this moving us forward and looking at what's happening in terms of the genetics of Britain today?
I think that study, the East London Genes and Health Study, is a really interesting and a really important study. There's a huge potential for genetics to tell us about human biology and human disease. We can learn from genetics what some of the causes are. We can also use it to help predict the consequences of different drug therapies. So to give you an example, typically when a pharmaceutical company develops a drug, what they're trying to do with that drug is to manipulate some aspect of human biology. Maybe they're trying to reduce the amount of protein that a particular gene produces. Up until now, we haven't really been able to know whether that will have the effect we want on reducing the disease they're interested in without doing a very large and extremely expensive clinical trial. So those trials cost billions of dollars. With our current ability to develop drugs, most of them aren't successful. Genetics also offers us a clue to try and understand what's going on with human biology. So if a drug is trying to reduce the output of a particular gene, we could take individuals who have chance genetic variants that reduce the output of that gene. And instead of having to give them the drug, that's as if nature is changing them in a way that might mimic the drug. We can just ask whether those people have less heart disease, and that gives us ways of learning about whether a drug might work, and there are analogous arguments which can help us learn about side effects and so on. So there's real potential for genetics to tell us about human biology and hence to improve our ability to develop drugs for diseases. To do that well, we want to cast our net as widely as possible. And there are particular reasons why studies in groups from other ancestry backgrounds, and in particular South Asian, give us complementary information to that which we currently have. Sometimes, and it might well be true in that population, cultural practices mean that certain genetic variants will be more common than they would otherwise be in individuals. They might occur twice in individuals rather than a single time. So it's a really valuable and interesting study, I think, that will use a modern, in this case, immigrant population to the UK to help us tease apart some of the really interesting aspects of genetics and health.
When you say cultural practices, are you talking here about cousin marriage or closely related parents marrying and having children?
That's one of the effects. So when closely related individuals marry, we get some of our DNA from our mother and some, we all get some of our DNA from our mother and some from our father. If our mother and father are related, then we might be getting the same piece of DNA twice. And that can mean that there's an increased frequency of people having two copies of a particular genetic variant. Now, sometimes that will be a very good thing. That will stop individuals getting a disease that they might have otherwise got, or reduce their chance of getting the disease. And if we can identify those and find out what they are, it tells us, firstly, some human biology that we didn't know previously, and secondly, might well point to things that we could think of as drug targets or ways of countering the diseases in question.
It's interesting because often you would associate cousin marriage with it being more likely that you would have rare genetic conditions that are harmful. But you're saying that looking in this population could actually help you find rare beneficial variants that protect you against diseases. Is that right?
Both those things are true. In populations where closely related people are more likely to marry, there will typically be increased incidence of rare genetic diseases. But the flip side of that is there's the possibility for learning about genetic changes which are very positive that we wouldn't really see in other populations. Those sorts of populations might have more rare disease, but they could be very helpful in helping us learn aspects of the genetics and help, hence the human biology of many of the common diseases that we suffer from.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the powerful platform that gives you simple tools to create a gorgeous website in minutes. With elegant templates, Getty image integration, and marketing tools, you can make your ideas resonate with the world. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
By the time you listen to this podcast, the most spectacular solar eclipse in Britain in 16 years may already have been and gone. But what are scientists hoping to learn from the eclipse? I'm joined by Dr. Hugh Morgan of Aberystwyth University. So Hugh, I understand you've chosen to stay in the cosy confines of your lab for the eclipse, but you've sent two of your students up to Svalbard in the Arctic Ocean, one of the two places on land that will experience a total eclipse. What will they be recording?
Well, we'll have about 14 different telescopes observing the corona during the total solar eclipse in many different wavelengths of light.
The corona is the very outer edge of the sun, beyond the surface, that rises up millions of miles.
The corona is the sun's atmosphere, and it extends from the sun all the way out into interplanetary space, and where it actually expands out into space and flows past the Earth, for example, as the solar wind.
And why is it that scientists are so interested in the corona?
There are many different reasons why we would want to study the corona. For me, the number one reason is it's just interesting scientifically. We also want to try to understand the corona because we can have huge explosions, for example, from the corona, which can fly out into space and affect modern technology on Earth. So this is one practical reason why we may want to understand the corona.
And as I understand it, there's also a huge mystery about why the corona's so hot. I was reading up about it, and the surface of the sun's only about 6,000 degrees C, but somehow the corona, which extends outwards, reaches millions of degrees. Do we know anything about why that might be?
It is one of the great mysteries of astronomy as to why the corona is so hot. But by now, there are a few plausible theories, competing theories in a way. One of the main theories is that we have magnetic waves. So the corona is a magnetized plasma. The magnetic field of the sun extends out through the corona and dominates the corona. And if we have waves in the magnetic field, it can somehow deposit energy in the corona and build it up to a million degrees.
And could this data from the eclipse solve the mystery?
The data from the eclipse is one piece of a large jigsaw, I would say, that takes us a step closer towards solving the mystery. What it does give is observational constraints. So we can say that this region is at a million degrees and another region is, say, at 2 million. And then we can look at the reasons why different regions have different temperatures.
Is it mostly better recordings of the temperatures that you'll be getting from the eclipse because the rest of the sun's blocked out?
Because the sun is blocked out, we get a unique opportunity to get very high-quality data of the corona. So we get some amazing images, detailed images of the corona from very near the sun to many, many millions of kilometres out to space. And really, it's only during an eclipse we get this quality of data. So it's a chance to learn a lot about the corona, not just the temperature.
Could these measurements tell us more about these eruptions that might affect technologies on Earth?
These eclipse measurements do give us clues as to how these eruptions may form and propagate through the corona. But again, it's one part of a large jigsaw, and there are many, many different missions with space telescopes observing the sun continuously. Every year, every decade, we get closer to answering these difficult questions.
Adam Vaughan from The Guardian's environment team joins me now. Adam, can you tell me about the campaign The Guardian launched this week?
So Alan Rudsbridger, our editor-in-chief, who's stepping down this summer, has decided he wants to make climate change his legacy issue. He's obviously committed a lot of resource to it in the past, but he's decided he wants to have a go at bringing it up the agenda as an issue. And the way we are going about this is by focusing on one particular issue, which is a thing called fossil fuel divestments. This is this pretty simple idea of companies, organisations, individuals taking their money out of oil, coal and gas companies to not so much try and financially bankrupt companies, but actually it's more about stigma. It's about delegitimising them on a sort of moral level. As part of the campaign that we've just launched, we are calling on the world's two biggest charitable funds, the Wellcome Trust and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in the US, to pull their money from fossil fuels.
And are you arguing that these two organisations, because they're scientific charities essentially, have a special responsibility when it comes to something like climate change?
I think we're very much saying these two foundations are the good guys. We're not trying to paint them as the bad guys at all. I think that we've sort of gone out of our way to highlight the good work, and the whole point we're targeting them is because of the really good work they're doing, particularly in the fields of health and development. And it really seems that taking a sort of long-term view, that the work they're doing in those areas and the grant giving that they're doing is being undercut by climate change and by the fact that they are contributing towards that by having their money in the very companies that are undoing the work they're doing elsewhere.
So these are charities with endowment funds of tens of billions of pounds. There's a lot of money at stake here. What do you think is going to happen? Do you think they're going to respond to the campaign?
Well, I think it's going to be, this is obviously the $60,000 question. I think this is going to be really interesting, as Alan has written. You know, you don't start a newspaper campaign without being able to win it. You know, he sort of said that we will win it eventually because the physics sort of demand it. I think we're just going to have to wait and see. I mean, I think we're obviously optimistic that they, being progressive, science-led institutions, they will listen to us. And to be fair to them, they are engaging with us, already talking with them. So I think we're just going to have to see whether they go the whole hog and do what we've asked them to do, or if there's some sort of halfway house, which we don't know what that might look like. But yeah, it's day two for us, so you know, we're at this point we are optimistic that that they will do something.
That's all we have time for this week. A big thank you to Peter Donnelly, Hugh Morgan and Adam Vaughan. From me and all of the science team, thanks for listening.